it is an almighty challenge that Chris Froome has set himself.
To say that there isn't a political strand to it, that's not going to wash with people, is it?
One of my other writers stood there and protected him, saying, "What do you know about this country?" Not because he's an Israeli, but because he's his teammate.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Hello, hello. I'm with Lionel. Where are we, Lionel?
We're in my Watford. Kitchen. We're not in Watford.
Daniel is in the satellite office of the Cycling Podcast in Berlin. But we're all about the Giro this week, aren't we? We've got the Giro route announcement to discuss. We've got lots to pack in. We're going to talk about the route. We're going to talk about the fact that Chris Froome has said he's riding. And we're also going to hear quite a lot of reaction to the start in Israel. But before we get on to any of that, Lionel, the news roundup. I know you're kind of rolling your eyes because I've probably just said all your news roundup.
I mean, the news roundup this week is extremely short because we're focusing so much on the Giro. Not an awful lot of other cycling news around at the moment. And I've been pretty busy with other things. I mean, I've just not had any time at all to do anything other than focus on the Giro d'Italia. But my focus is 100% on the. It's 101% on the 101st Giro route. We already knew that the race would start in Israel with three stages, and then we'll transfer to Sicily for three stages. Another visit to Mount Etna, going up a different side to the race this year, 2017. And then it's kind of slightly familiar, certainly for me anyway, having covered the last couple of Giri, the kind of long stages straight up the middle to get to the north and the mountains. It's not overly mountainous. The Zonkalan is back. There's a wine trial. Will it be a wine trial? I have to ask Daniel that, in Trentino. And then it's Cervinia is the big last mountain stage on the final Saturday before the finish in Rome. An interesting route. I don't know Italy as well as France, so I'm not the man really to kind of talk about what's on the menu, but we'll hear from Daniel on that. But the other big bit of news is that Chris Froome, the defending Tour de France and Vuelta a España champion, will try to complete the Froome Slam. I think we're going to call it that, aren't we? If he does do that, hold all three Grand Tour titles at once. He has confirmed that he'll be on the start line in Jerusalem in May.
Last person to do that, Lionel?
Oh, I looked this up as well this morning when I switched my focus back to cycling.
Bernardino.
It was Bernardino in 82-3.
82 into 83. Yeah, he won the Giro and the Tour in 82, and then he won the Vuelta when it was obviously before the Giro and the Tour in 83. We talked about this a bit in our event with Chiro a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? But he did damage, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but he did injure his knee quite badly in the Vuelta, in winning the Vuelta. Almost ended his career, really. It took him a while to come back from that. Not suggesting that that was the inevitable consequence of, you know, winning three Grand Tours in a row. But it's certainly an almighty challenge, the one that, you know, Nairo Quintana tried this year, having won the Vuelta, ridden the Tour, won the Vuelta, then tried to win the Giro and came up short. So it is an almighty challenge that Chris Froome has set himself. We will talk about that in a moment or two. As I say, we'll talk about the Israel start in part two and part three perhaps as well. But initially, I mean, Daniel, you're our sort of honorary Italian. What are your thoughts on the route? Sicily again? Is this, you know, is part of the thinking there, Vincenzo Nibali, obviously at the peak of his powers, is he going to ride? He was at the presentation. Is he going to ride the Giro next year, or talk of him perhaps going back to the Tour de France instead? No?
I spoke to his Bahrain Merida team manager, Brent Copeland, this morning, in fact, about the likelihood of Nibali going. He seemed a bit nonplussed, Nibali did yesterday, with the route announcement. In the past couple of weeks, he suggested that if there was a heavy dose of of Sicilian stages, then that would perhaps swing things in favour of him doing the Giro. But he didn't seem convinced yesterday, and they're going to make a decision over the next few days. The real difference this year is that the Sicilian stages look very difficult, very challenging, and they are the kind of terrain where Nibali will probably come to the fore. There were three hilly stages, one summit finish up Mount Etna, which is a harder side than the race went up this year, but particularly the stage to Caltagirone is very tricky looking. It has the sort of profile of an Ardennes classic. But I think all of the Grand Tour contenders are really in the same boat, aren't they? They're weighing up the Giro and the Tour. And in some ways, two sort of atypical, unusual routes for both races this year. You've got the Tour de France, which is maybe more climbing and steeper climbs than we're accustomed to seeing. And the Giro, which, based on what I've seen so far and what I can garner from looking at the route profiles, will feature a lot of quite long climbs, not particularly steep by Giro standards, a very fleeting visit to the Dolomites. I think, you know, it's a question of, for a lot of those guys, figuring out what's going to be the best terrain and also where their rivals are going to go. And I think that's going to be key to Nibali, because I think he's sick to the back teeth of being beaten by Chris Froome.
So Froome riding might tilt the balance towards a tour for Nibali. I know he wants a real crack at some of the classics, Liège-Bastogne-Liège and races like that as well. Not long between Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the Giro next year, so that could be this could be compatible aims. Who knows?
Chris Froome announcing that he's going to ride the Giro. Anyone else thinking the Giro might be the race for them next year? Their hearts probably sank a little bit hearing that news, and maybe there'll be some riders who will reassess a little bit. But I really hope not. I hope it's a competitive race, and that we don't just see a kind of a sky procession. If they're strong enough and good enough to win the race, all fine, that's absolutely fine. But it would be good to think that there will be at least a couple of heavyweight challengers that will take on the Giro.
Well, it's also the unknown, isn't there? I mean, Sky have never come close to winning the Giro. They've ridden it every time, but never come remotely close to winning the Giro, despite having a couple of really good cracks with Richie Porte 1 year, of course, and Mikel Landa, Geraint Thomas last year, who knows what would have happened there. But they've never come close. And it is a different race. It's a different style of race and different roads. And so they will not go into it with the sort of confidence that they go to the tour with. And for them too, I mean, Chris Froome is one part of the equation, but how do you decide on the teams that will support him at these two races? It's really, really, from a sporting point of view, I think we kind of relish this, don't we?
Certainly. And the other big factor is whether Froome and Sky are hoping for the Giro to be the first part of a potential double, winning the Tour and the Tour de France afterwards. I mean, a lot has been said about the fact that the gap between the two races is 5 weeks this year as opposed to four, which it is most years, and that's because the Tour de France is starting a week later, largely because the Football World Cup will be on at the same time, and they like to avoid a clash with all the matches going on. That will have an impact. I mean, depending on who you talk to, that either tilts the balance in favour of the double being possible or away from it. Daniel, I just remember us sitting on the rest day in just on the outskirts of Spoleto last year at the Giro. Nairo Quintana had just taken the pink jersey at Blockhouse, and we were thinking, well, this is Quintana's all the way now. Let's make a kilometre zero about the double. And of course, it's an awful lot harder than just thinking all you have to do is get into pink and defend to the finish and then just rock up at the Tour. I think it's a much bigger challenge than the Tour of Vuelta double that Chris Froome has just completed.
I can remember as Lionel driving through a monsoon to buy a pink and a yellow ice cream for the purposes of a photo to go with this special. Appropriately, actually, because we're on stage seven of next year's Giro, we're going to Pizzo in Calabria, which is renowned for having Some of the best ice cream in Italy.
One of the finest metaphors of the year, Daniel, was that I dropped that ice cream on the floor before I'd even managed to start enjoying it, which perhaps tells you all you need to know about attempting the double.
On the date change line, of course, next year, one thing it does have in common with the last successful double attempt, 1998 Pantani, is that date change, for the same reasons, because of the World Cup. So there's an extra week. I mean, just looking at the two routes, I think from the point of view of Froome's rivals, my attention would be drawn to the first 2 weeks of the respective races, because they're the places, and perhaps the last week of the Tour de France, it's there that Froome, I think, is going to be particularly vulnerable, because he'll want to go into the Giro slightly undercooked, as he was, I think, at the Tour de France this year. And in those stages in Sicily are very, very challenging. And you might, as a rival of Chris Froome, you might want to hit him really hard there and really test him. And then, you know, I remember when we did make that program last year, the podcast on the double, we talked a lot about the first week of Pantani's Tour de France. Obviously, different times, different era. Cycling was very different in 1998. But, you know, if you remember that 1998 tour, and the start of it was really overshadowed by the Festina scandal, and the peloton sort of dawdled through the first week, and it wasn't particularly challenging from the point of view of the route either. They were very, very flat, those stages. And, you know, certainly speaking to Giuseppe Martinelli, the director sportif who led Pantani to that double, that was really key in terms of Pantani being able to pull it off. And then you look at the Tour de France this year and the first week, and we had the pleasure of Matt White, the Orica Scott direct sportif. He came to our events last week, didn't he? And he was talking about how difficult the first week of the Tour is going to be, and how, you know, half the contenders could be gone at the end of the first week. So if Froome, you know, he wants to rest between the Giro and the Tour, and he wants to again come into the Tour very well rested and relaxed, and perhaps with a decent margin for his form to grow again, then it's going to be a risky game to play, isn't it? Because they're going to come at him pretty hard in that first week of the Tour.
Matt White also said that he felt that Froome had really ridden both the Tour and, well, the Vuelta, but especially the Tour within himself. Mm. That he felt that he really had a lot more to give there that he didn't really need to give. And so, you know, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because even last week, Matt White was pretty shocked to hear how likely it was that Froome was going to ride the Giro. He certainly, that took him by surprise, because they've got that earmarked for Esteban Chavez next year. And that will really maybe force a rethink on their part. But I have to say, I've been getting a lot of well-deserved stick, as we call it, bants on Twitter for saying very confidently a few weeks ago, when it was first reported that Froome might ride the Giro, I confidently asserted there was zero chance of Froome riding the Giro. And
in mitigating circumstances, that's because he told you that.
He did. I was in Monaco at the start of October for a forthcoming Friends special. It'll be our first Friends special of 2018. Nice little early plug there. I had lunch with him. Orla Chenoui had lunch with Michelle Froome, his wife. And these two interviews will appear in our first Friends special of next year, available soon. However, we talked a bit about the Giro. He was very aware of the controversy surrounding the start, and it's certainly adamant that it wasn't going to feature in his plans for next year. He did talk about riding the Giro at some point in the future, but the priority, certainly, he didn't want to do anything next year to jeopardise the possibility of a fifth Tour de France win. So something changed dramatically after that meeting. That, as I say, that was in early October. I think it was the 12th of October, and it all changed. And when I said that on Twitter, I got contacted by a couple of people who would know to tell me that things had changed quite a bit, and that, you know, that it was really being analysed by the coaches at Team Sky, Tim Kerrison and so on, to see whether they thought it was possible or not physically. But let's not kid ourselves. We are sure that money is a factor here too. I think, you know, that Froome has probably been offered quite a lot of money to start the Giro. Just an addendum to that claim of mine that Chris Froome is being paid start money to appear at the Giro d'Italia. I'm recording this now a few hours after we recorded the podcast, since when Mauro Vegni, the Giro director, has flatly denied that Chris Froome is being paid by RCS to ride the Giro. Daniel went to Team Sky for clarification. They said that their policy is not to comment on any dialogue with race organisers.
Just going back onto the route and that will face Chris Froome and everybody else. Daniel, what are the other highlights we should be looking out for? I mentioned that at the start that the Zonkalan is back for the first time since 2014. It's a kind of a bit of a modern classic, really, the Zonkalan, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Chris Froome hates it. That's one thing to bear in mind when we're talking about his decision to ride. It's his least favorite climb of all time. I think he did it in, would it have been 2010, did he ride the Giro? I mean, as regards the mountaintop finishes, the thing that immediately jumped out at me was that they're quite benign, a lot of them. Certainly the Mercogliani Montevergine on the first week is it's almost inaccurate to call it a mountain stage. You generally see, well, the Giro goes there quite often, and you generally see 30, 40 riders almost sprinting for the win there. The Gran Sasso d'Italia is the next mountaintop finish, the next day, in fact, and that's not too difficult either. Pantani won there in 1999, but it was a pretty good, decent sized group that came in behind him, and the really, really hard stages are the ones to Sappada, which of course was made famous by the 1987 Giro and Stephen Roach's act of insurrection against Roberto Vicentini, and
who was his teammate?
Who was his teammate?
Attacked his teammate and refused to wait, didn't he?
Yeah, and then
friend special.
The Jaffa,
the friend special this year.
The fantastically named Jaffarao stage with the Colle delle Finestre, the paved road up there, and that actually comes pretty early in the stage. The Finestre, it comes 70 kilometers from the finish, but then there's another climb to Sestriere, then the Jaffarao. So that's a real blockbuster. And then the last big mountain stage, well, the penultimate day, in fact, another one in the Alps to Cervinia in the sort of shadow of the Matterhorn, but it's on a big wide road. We saw, well, Ryder Heisdahl, I think, take time out of Joaquin Rodriguez decisively in the 2012 Giro on that climb, and it's not a particularly intimidating one. So beyond the beyond the Zonkalan and the Finestre, and then a couple of the climbs on that day to Sappada, there is nothing that would make anyone sort of cower in their cleats, I wouldn't say.
And lastly, the time trial, it's a wine trial again, isn't it?
It is. The wines, or the wines grown in that region, are less well known than the ones that have been connected with the wine trial in the last few years. So it's you should be looking out there, Lionel, for Marzemino and Terol de Go, which are both red wines. But there's some white, decent white wine there as well. Actually, on that subject, something that's been in the news in Italy, did you know that Francesco Moser's son, Ignazio Moser, who I can't remember whether he turned pro with the BMC Pro team or just rode for their development team. Anyway, he quit cycling a couple of years ago, and he's been in Celebrity Big Brother. This has not.
He's also been racing. He raced the Nocturne last year on the Fixie.
Correct. He races on Fixies, and he's also a big friend of the podcast, Filippo Pozzato, as you would imagine, because Ignazio Moser, among other things, in Celebrity Big Brother in Italy, has bragged of having had 170 different women in his bed, not at the same time. And this has not impressed his father, Francesco, the 1984 Giro winner, who has said that he needs to come back and work on the vineyard and stop mucking around in the Big Brother house.
Quite right.
And he got voted out this week, apparently. I don't know. I read this in Gazzetta this morning.
It sounds it was as rigged as the 84 Giro d'Italia.
I could give you some more quotes about what he said about the art of seduction, but I think I'll leave that for another podcast.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Yes, thank you to Rafa, our main sponsor at the Cycling Podcast. The clothing, Pedaleur de Charme clothing made by Rafa, is available again, I think, on the website, or certainly coming very, very soon. Go to the cyclingpodcast.com shop and it'll take you to our page on the Rafa website. And the Pedaleur de Charme range coming very, very soon. T-shirts first and then jerseys, so look out for that.
I'm just relieved, Rich, after Daniel lowered the tone with talk of Italian Big Brother, that we managed to scramble up onto the highbrow ground again with a message from our sponsors this week, The Economist, and from our title sponsors, Rafa. I mean, it was all getting a bit too...
otherwise. I think we rescued that. We managed to just fade Daniel out there. That's the advantage of him being in Berlin. We control the knobs here, so to speak, and we just managed to... Turn the volume down on Daniel. Let's fade him back up again. Daniel, are you back again? Are you there?
Yep.
Okay, well, listen, in this part, we've got some audio packages to play. First of all, we're going to hear from Hannah Troop, Our Lady in the Desert. She reported for us from the Middle East last year.
Does she only get dusted off when there are trips to the desert? She's more versatile than that.
She is far more versatile than that, yeah.
She came to London last week and was at our event at the Arts Theatre.
She was.
We haven't talked about...
You might have met her because Hannah was in the lobby speaking to a few of the people who were there for the podcast.
On a camel. No,
that's not her mode of transport in London. And Hannah is going to be appearing more on the Cycling Podcast Femina, I hope, in the new year with myself and Orla Chinoui. Actually, on that subject, we released the November episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina this week. That was a conversation with Hannah Barnes and Mika Kruger, the Canyon SRAM riders, recorded in Manchester earlier this year. So that's in all the usual places. And the December episode of that will be coming soon as well. We were recently offered a trip to Israel, courtesy of RCS, to go and have a look at some of the places, obviously Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, where the Giro will go to next year for the start. We none of us could go. Hannah went in our place. So we should say at the outset, this was a trip organized by and paid for by RCS. She mainly spoke to some members of the Israeli Cycling Academy team, who we fully expect to get a wild card for the Giro next year. They have stepped up in terms of riders. Some high-profile riders have joined the team this winter, and they look set to ride the Giro next year. So she spoke to a few of the people involved in that team. We'll hear her package first. It lasts about 12 minutes or so. We'll then go straight into an interview that I did recently, a couple of weeks ago now, with Omar Barghouti, who one of the main people behind the BDS movement, that's Boycott, Divest and Sanctions movement. And it's part of a wider effort to arrange sort of cultural, artistic boycotts of Israel. Omar Barghouti is a real leading figure in this movement. Now, I spoke to him as well just about, you know, the view that they were taking on the Giro start in Israel. He says some pretty strong, provocative things, and we will come back after that and discuss some of that and what it might mean for the Giro start in Israel, which is already mired in controversy, having after the launch yesterday, where they described the RCS in their route presentation, described the start in West Jerusalem, which the Israeli government took great exception to and threatened to actually withdraw their support, pointing out that in their view, it is not West. There isn't a West Jerusalem. There is only a Jerusalem. However, this is all wading into very murky waters, and we will get onto that eventually. Let's hear first from Hannah Troop, speaking to some members of the Israeli Cycling Academy team, and then from Omar Barghouti.
My name is Ron, and I'm the founder of the Cycling Academy, which is the first ever Israeli professional cycling team. And we launched it 3-4 years ago with a dream to participating in a grand tour with the Israeli flag. And this dream is on the verge of coming true.
Has it grown faster than what you expected it to?
We had a big dream, and it grew a bit faster than I expected, yes. You know, that's the beautiful thing. When you have a baby, at a certain stage, it grows his own way. and you just have to let it grow its own way. We never foresaw a Grand Tour so early. We came to a very high level, and we are a very big team by now, and I told you, 500,000 followers on Facebook, and we have a nice story to tell on top of the professional. So we started with the Elite professional team, and then we understood that in order to get good Israeli riders into the Elite team, we need a development project, because there's no tradition of, like in Italy or France, of grassroots growing cyclists. So we have a development team of eight cyclists. You saw them today sitting here. And most of the mountain bikers that we converted into road cycling. And they are, some of them are joining the LA team. One of them was announced today. And we also want to have a better cooperation with the local clubs in the small villages. So we have the clubs, the grassroots, then the development team, and then us. Now, the army is a big obstacle. We have a special program for excellent riders or sportsmen. So they do sort of a semi-army, so they can have more time to cycle. Guy Sagiv, Israel national champ, was mentioning that he was in the military when he joined the team, and that was a big issue. So definitely it's an issue, but we are coping with it.
So I'm Guy Sagiv, I'm 22 years old, I'm ready for the Israel Cycling Academy. I'm the former Israel national champion.
Okay, so yesterday we were talking about kind of how things are when you're on the cycling team and the military service. This story came out a little bit about you actually going against your military service or the rules and regulations and actually going to the Qatar world. So just take us through how that happened and what was your kind of like thought process about it?
Yeah, I thought it's just the right way to do, the right thing to do. I was considering to give up at one point because they say it's not allowed, and I didn't want to say to do something that I'm not allowed to do. But after I decided I want to be a cyclist for the rest of my life, as much as I can, obviously, and I think it was part of it. I got that decision, and I'm going for it 100%, no matter what. And that was I did that the thing. I went without the permission, although they say no. And in the end, it was I was just getting a warning, not do it again. It was okay.
Because so, what would normally be the sort of like the penalty for doing that?
It depends on the commander, and depends what their decision. But normally it's jail, because it's a Muslim country. We have no relation with them. It was dangerous, I admit, but.
Because that surely, having that to deal with in your head and then going into a world championship competition, I mean, that must have been quite scary, no?
Actually, it was not so scary, no. I thought it would be scarier, but I felt 100% confident. I felt comfortable there, and there was no problem with that.
So thinking about actually potentially having the chance to ride in the Giro next year, what does that mean to you?
We really hope to get the invitation for next year. The wildcard will be announced only in January, I think. So up until there, we have only the option to wait. So we'll see what will be the answer. But I think we are deserve it. We deserve the place. We'll be a good team, better team next year, with some big names in our roster. And I think we're at the right level to do it. It's not like we have a special. Special opportunity because it starts here in Israel. I think we actually deserve it, and that's a great thing.
I'm Dennis from Inde, and I'm racing for a cycling academy, and it's a lot of fun.
So when did you first find out about Israeli Cycling Academy?
Actually, to be honest, last year I was not able to stay with Lotto Jumbo, and I started looking around, and then you... Of course, you start in the beginning to look at the World Tour teams, and then you go down. And then I saw that the Pro Continental teams. I saw Israel Cycling Academy, and I started to talk with riders about it, talk with the management, and they have a beautiful motivation and a nice plan. And Like you can see, the team is growing really hard, and I'm happy to be a part of that.
So when did you find out that the Giro was planning on coming to Jerusalem? Was that kind of said to you that that was going to be part of the of their idea and their plan?
Cause obviously no, what I understood is that they always have the ambitions to grow towards a Grand Depart in a Grand Tour, and I think it's coming a little bit faster than they expected, and it's also, yeah, to at least to me, it's a surprise that it can happen in Israel. So it would be amazing if, as Israel Israel Cycling Academy, to start your home Grand Tour. That would be that would be amazing. Like I'm from Holland. I race for a team that had always a Dutch license. So most of the riders were from the Netherlands, and here it's like a real mix. We have guys from Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, Israel, Latvia, Estonia, and it's a great mix. And I'm really happy that my teammates, my friends, are also coming to Girona. I think everybody loves it. I'm a big fan of Girona.
And lastly, what was your, as when you first came to Israel to see the country, what was the biggest thing that shocked you about coming and seeing the country?
Well, yeah, like you can call me really naive. Like I was telling my friends, my family, that I was going to visit Israel last December, and they were like, "Oh, are you sure about that?" And I was like, "Are you sure about it? What do you mean?" Oh yeah, if you watch the news, if you watch CNN, they show the bad things, but I mean, I spent now some weeks here, and I've never felt pressure or I didn't feel secure. Like I felt great, and we race as athletes, so we don't have politics or religion as standard. So I think that's amazing.
Hi, I'm Ran Margaliot. I'm a general manager of Israel Cycling Academy, Israel's first and only pro cycling team.
So can you just give us a bit of a short summary of like how the Israeli Academy got sort of started and why it did, really?
So this is a kind of a different kind of project. We really wanted to start a development team because Israel doesn't have any development structure for pro cycling. But soon we realized we have to give these guys a bit more, you know. If we would have just developed them and then sent them to different teams, no other team would really understand them. So in the end of 2014, when we started it, the initial ambition was to create a development structure. And soon we decided we're just going to grow, create sort of an organic growth structure to grow with the riders. And here we are.
And, I mean, this is obviously, I was speaking to Ron earlier, it's grown so quickly over the last few years, more than what you first thought.
Yes.
Did you originally, when you first started it, kind of like think about what it could potentially stand for?
Although some of the things we do may look like a little bit like we are looking for the drama or to raise attention, we really try to use the team to show the world what Israel really is. And the way I know Israel, Israel is a melting pot of all cultures, giving people an opportunity in a place where people sometimes get few opportunities. You know, we are a startup nation, we are very entrepreneur in our approach, we are very young, we want to punch way above our weight. And our aim with this team is really to showcase that also places like Israel, non-cycling places, also riders coming from those places, also teams like us racing against all odds can make it and inspire young people coming from places like Israel to do the same thing.
And when you talk to the young guys, you've got quite a few neo-pros that are going to come through on the development team. And so when you say to them, look, okay, this is not going to be the easiest of journey, you are going to get times where there's going to be negativity. How do you talk to them to try and get them to deal with that or cope with that?
Well, the thing is, eventually, there's nothing I can do to really prepare them, you know, for the real world. So I'm a true believer in rolling with the punches, you know. This is what cycling is all about. It's like you do a tactic brief before the race, saying it's going to be that, I'm going to do that. Racing is not about planning. Racing is about reacting, it's about living the moment. Same thing about the world we live in today. You know, we signed this Turkish rider today because we believe we give him an amazing opportunity to achieve his life dream. Never a Turkish rider has raced in this level. Maybe tomorrow, I don't know, he changed his mind because I don't know who told him what, and he decides something else. It's his own life. But I'm a true believer in following your dreams, you know, making a plan. We need to have a plan in place, committing to a plan, working hard towards it, and as we always says, maximum which will succeed, you know, maximum which will work.
And when you think about kind of like changing perception, how do you think the Giro is going to help do that next year?
I think eventually what this structure needs to be, what this team needs to be, it needs to be an honest platform for people to look at and say, this is real. This is something I can identify with. This is something I feel that stands, that's aligned with my values, you know. And this is not something you can fake. I cannot put words in their mouth saying, listen, say this and this and this and we will look cool and they will quote us. They need to stand, you need to be there and to believe in it. When you're bringing a non-Israeli rider, racing for this team, sometimes getting some of those comments, you know. I mean, some of those things you just cannot put in his mouth. They need to feel it this way. When Roy started describing, he was in the Basque Country and he got some bad reaction from someone who didn't like very much the fact he's wearing a jersey with the flag of his country. One of my other riders stood there and protected him, saying, "What do you know about this country?" Not because he's an Israeli, but because he's his teammate. He's his teammate. He cares about him. He protects him. This is what the sport stands for. We bring people together. We help each other. We support each other. We work together towards a goal. Some need to sacrifice more in a given day. Some need to sacrifice less. We win and we lose, but the thing is, we are following our passion, and this passion can bring people together.
So that was Hannah in Israel, and then we're now going to hear an interview with Omer Barghouti from BDS, a group that has been leading the calls for the Giro not to start in Israel, and getting a lot of press attention, especially in the last few days. We felt it was important to hear what they have to say, though needless to say, playing an interview does not mean that we are endorsing all of the group's views or tactics, some of which have generated controversy.
My name is Omer Barghouti. I'm one of the founders of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS, Movement for Palestinian Rights, and the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel.
I mean, the reasons for contact here were obvious. It's set to be a big story next year, the start of the Giro in Israel. What was your reaction to the news that the Giro was going to start there?
Let me start with the macro level, where we see a real problem. By holding the race anywhere under Israeli control, while Israel's regime of occupation, colonialism, and apartheid escalates its oppression of the Palestinians, escalates its illegal settlements, Giro d'Italia is therefore consciously participating in whitewashing Israel's violations of international law. Palestinian civil society cannot accept this type of complicity by a prestigious sports organization to help Israel in branding itself in its propaganda efforts to present itself to the world as a normal, dynamic, liberal society, covering up its military occupation that's been going on for 50 years, its denial of refugee rights, and its system of apartheid, as shown in a UN report issued earlier this year.
Is this something that, you know, the Giro, I think, will be one of, if not the highest profile sports events to be held there? But is this a pattern that you're seeing, that there are more efforts being made? We're very aware of adverts for tourism in Israel, and this is part of the drive to increase tourism as well. But are you aware of a kind of renewed drive to attract major events like this to Israel?
Absolutely. Israel's failure to quell the immense, impressive growth of the BDS movement in the last few years, as BDS reaches mainline churches, trade unions, LGBT groups, women's groups, anti-war groups, and so on, Israel feels the pressure that it's facing a near future like apartheid South Africa. It's getting more and more isolated in the world, in the academic sphere, sports, culture, and increasingly economically as well. As a result, Israel is intensifying its so-called Brand Israel campaign, whereby it's spending hundreds of millions of dollars on polishing its image, trying to attract major music, sports, and other events to Tel Aviv, for example, major music bands, major film directors, writers, sports figures, and so on. Because it realizes its public image is fast deteriorating. According to a recent BBC poll, the Globe Scan of International Public Opinion, Israel ranked fourth from the bottom in terms of its popularity around the world. So Israel realizes that the BDS movement, coupled with Israel's shift to the far right, its association with xenophobic right groups across Europe, with the Trump administration in the US, Israel being today a model for the far right, actually, in Europe and the US, this is, and the growth of BDS are both leading to a fast deterioration in its public image. So it needs Giro d'Italia, it needs such major cultural and sports events to whitewash, to cover up its regime of oppression.
How do you think it will play out when we get to Israel in, you know, early May, when the Giro starts? It's already provoking an awful lot of controversy. Bike racing is kind of uniquely open, accessible, vulnerable too. It happens on the open road. It doesn't happen in contained arenas. How do you think it will play out once we get there?
Well, there are two points. Giro d'Italia has a plan B if the start in Israel does not work out for any reason. And we're calling on it to actually implement the plan B and move the race, relocate the race to another country that is not as egregiously involved in human rights violations as Israel. But Palestinian civil society organizations, as well as partner organizations in Italy and throughout Europe, are mobilizing to convince participating teams, sponsors, and cycling federations to pressure Giro d'Italia to relocate the race. If Giro insists on being part of Israel's branding, its whitewashing of its crimes, then we'll have no choice but to stage lively, nonviolent protests in Palestine, in Italy, and elsewhere along the path of the race, to convince the world that no, Israel is not a normal country. It's an oppressive regime that's practicing apartheid and occupation against the Palestinians. We will not sit back while Giro partners with Israel's propaganda machine in portraying deceptive images of the state. And Richard, you brought up a very important point that races, especially cycling races, are about openness and open space, which exactly contradicts the lack of freedom of movement that Palestinians face. So Palestinian cyclists as well are telling the world, not just Bahraini and Emirati cycling teams, but world cyclists, that we are denied freedom of movement. When we cycle in any direction, we hit the Israel wall, which is illegally built on occupied Palestinian territory. We hit the borders of an illegal Israeli settlement. We hit a military checkpoint. We are denied freedom of movement. How can you come and celebrate the cycling event as if it's a normal country when we are denied our basic freedom of movement? So we are reaching out with this simple message to the world of cycling and to human rights organizations around the world to condemn Giro's decision and hopefully to pressure to reverse it.
That was Omar Barghouti, and we have no doubt that we will get lots of feedback from playing the interview. Many argue that their aims are entirely appropriate and justified. Many others feel very strongly that they are not. As he said, his group's aim in this case is simply to stop the Giro starting in Israel. But as he also said, in the event that it does go ahead as planned, his group will stage lively but non-violent protests.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And of course, you, the listener, can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com, entering the code CPAUG20 at the checkout. So fill your boots. Now, before we heard from Science and Sport, we heard from Omar Barghouti, and before that, from members of the Israel Cycling Academy team speaking to Hannah Troop. So very different views there of the start of the Giro in Israel. Just today, the day that we're recording, we were reading an interview with Sylvain Adams, the man, the billionaire Canadian who recently moved to Israel. And he's believed to be the man behind, or one of the driving forces, certainly behind both the team and the Giro start in Israel. And he came out with some pretty interesting comments, certainly arguing that that politics and sport shouldn't mix, and that any efforts to portray the Giro start in Israel as anything other than a positive story were disingenuous in his view. Now that doesn't really square with the reaction of the Israeli government, for example, to the faux pas, if we can call it that, by RCS Giro in the route presentation calling the start West Jerusalem rather than Jerusalem. Clearly, that's already getting political, isn't it? That the threat to withdraw their support for that slight.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to try and separate sport and politics because sport and politics are intertwined and always have been. And there, you know, so much precedent for that statement that sometimes I think that people who do say, oh, we shouldn't bring politics into sport, actually just want to kind of draw a curtain over something. I don't want to widen the debate out into an irrelevant area, but the Colin Kaepernick, protests in American football, you know, an awful lot of the discussion around that was people saying, well, sport and politics shouldn't mix. And I just think that's a willfully naive position to take, really, because when you're holding an international sports event in a place, there are all sorts of things bound up in it. Commerce, tourism, politics. There's a political reason why Israel wants to be hosting an event as large and prestigious as a Giro, and it's probably because there's a lot of bang for buck. You know, it's not like hosting a major sort of soccer tournament or something that would cost, you know, hundreds of millions.
They're paying $10 million, it's reported.
So, you know, it's probably a fairly good investment. But to say that there isn't a political strand to it is, I think, that's not going to wash with people, is it? Because there certainly is. You know, there's so much bound up in the territory of Israel.
And I don't think we want to particularly get into the politics of it ourselves. We're in playing those interviews in the last part. We want to listen to the different views around this subject. But already, you know, months away from the start, it's already generating a lot of controversy and really strong feelings. And I think the Giro has been almost naive and willfully naive, perhaps, in thinking this wouldn't happen. But one of the interesting things for me in the interview with Omar Barghouti was he said, and seemed to say so with some knowledge of the situation, that there is a plan B for the Giro. If for whatever reason the Israel start proves to be impossible, and I thought that was very, very interesting and not perhaps surprising.
Venyi himself has actually confirmed that, Rich, that there is a plan B, and which I think would mean the race would still restart from Sicily, but I think there'd be three more stages crammed into the south of Italy. I think that's where the plan B would be.
But that shows, doesn't it, an awareness of, you know, I mean, the Giro, when we were talking about this earlier before we started recording, there's almost a sense that the Giro's pretending that there isn't any controversy around this. I mean, their route announcement, which is normally the day or 2 days after Tour of Lombardy, was delayed this year to November the 29th. There were some rumours about why that was, but it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that 29th of November is International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. And there are various other sort of moves. You know, the Israeli team has signed a Turkish Muslim rider, rumours that he will be, you know, perhaps first off the start ramp and the time trial in Jerusalem. And there are various things that they're doing to try and soften it, to try and present it as a multi-faith, multi-ethnic, multinational gathering of people and faiths and all the rest of it. But that sort of just papers over some pretty big cracks in this whole endeavour, does it not?
I think, as Lionel said, without getting into the sort of positives and the negatives, I mean, what we do object to, will object to, is people pretending that none of this is going on and pretending that it isn't an issue. Venyi said a few weeks ago, we want to stay away from politics. Well, you can't do that when the race in its essence is to celebrate a landscape, its history. When Venyi, for example, last year for the 100th Giro referenced Garibaldi's campaign to unify Italy in the 1860s, you know, when the whole principle of the race is that is that of a tour of a geopolitical entity, a nation. I mean, to give RCS some credit, they've tried to be sensitive. I think they've consulted with the Italian Foreign Office about the route. We don't know whether calling it West Jerusalem was a mistake or whether that was another example of them trying to be sensitive. But I think they've stepped into a viper's nest. I mean, my feeling is that you can't have your cake and eat it. You can't say you want to stay away from politics, but then take money being spent to serve an ostensibly political agenda. That is making Israel look quote unquote normal. You know, people call this sort of sports cleansing. I'm sure from what I've read that the gentleman behind this, Sylvan Adams, is also very interested in promoting bike use in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and I'm sure that he has noble aims as well. But you know, the problem sometimes we have with cycling now is we've got this sport that's desperate to grow and absolutely convinced that it has this huge untapped commercial potential. And there's also a growing number of people with a lot of money who see its potential for other things, to serve agendas that have nothing to do with boosting cycling. And you know, unfortunately for those people, it seems to me that cycling is a pretty adult, well-educated demographic that will ask questions and will have misgivings about what's going on here. And in some ways, I think the doping crises of the last 20 years have made cycling neurotic and paranoid, but they've also made cycling's public highly sensitive to issues with moral implications, and that's a good thing.
It always strikes me as hugely ironic that countries, regimes, which are, you know, don't necessarily encourage questioning. I'm thinking of China and the Beijing Olympics, Russia and the World Cup or the Sochi Olympics. In hosting these events, in attracting them and hosting them, all they do is shine a light on themselves. And so it has the opposite aim to the intended aim. It's supposed to be a PR exercise a lot of the time, but what it actually does is raise awareness of some of the problems. And I mean, let's not, you know, restrict this discussion to Israel. I mean, we made a sort of cack-handed attempt to give an ethical report on all the teams, and you know, there are lots of questions to be asked about a lot of the sponsors of a lot of the teams in professional cycling and where, you know, a lot of the money is coming from.
Yeah, but that's sports.
That's the world.
Relationship with, you know, with politics in a nutshell, isn't it? Sport is a useful tool for corporations and countries. You mentioned the Beijing Olympics, Rich. I remember, you know, when Beijing was awarded the Olympics in 2008 and human rights activists were saying, well, this needs to shine a light on, you know, some of the things going on in China. And to a degree, I mean, I learned about what went on in China as a result of the Olympics being there. So I suppose that does bear out your point a bit, in that it did raise awareness of some of the things going on. It's just that sport moves in and out, doesn't it? You know, the Olympics were held, they were wonderful, and then everything moved on. And you, if you look at sort of Amnesty and international reports into countries, you know, China's, you know, some aspects of Chinese life haven't really moved on at all, as you know, since 2008. And so you wonder, you know, sport does find itself in a position where it gets used, basically. And, you know, the people who run sport don't seem to mind that. And that's one of the things that kind of sits uneasily with me, really, is that it can be very easy to, you know, working within sport and sports events, you know, picking and choosing which moral issues to pick up and which to put down and when to pick them up and put them down. And that's the inconsistency that will sit very uneasily with a lot of people.
Jeremy, one could say, Lionel, that we're already seeing evidence of how the Giro is being used in this issue of, you know, what to call the star, West Berlin or... Oh, sorry, West Berlin.
You're 30 years out of date. Yeah.
West Jerusalem. That's the second time I've made that mistake in a conversation.
With,
yeah, I'm in the East at the moment.
of course you are.
But, you know, that's perhaps evidence of, you know, it already being instrumentalized and the way they've planned the routes again, probably to be sensitive. They're not going to any of the occupied territories, but again, it's almost, you know, it's almost kind of airbrushing the part of Israel that they don't want people to see, and the peoples, the groups that they don't want people to see. They do want to project a sanitized version of Israel, which obviously doesn't sit well with a lot of people.
I mean, I thought there was an air of panic in the press release this morning from the Giro in response to this crisis, this controversy that's blown up as a result of them referring to West Jerusalem in the presentation. You know, there's a lot at stake for them, not least the money. And looping it back to the fact that Chris Froome is riding the Giro, reportedly for a lot of money. RCS are committed to making that payment, but presumably the money that they're getting from Israel is a big factor in their financial planning for the Giro next year. If anything was to happen and the plan B was executed, then that would be a big loss for RCS and they would still be committed to paying the money that they're reportedly paying Chris Froome.
That just bears out my point that this is all, you know, these things are all interconnected, aren't they? And, you know, if if countries use sport as a tool, then the sports use the athletes as a tool. And Chris Froome finds himself in that position. And he will come under scrutiny for that and will no doubt be asked about it. You know, I know we're all very careful not to say, you know, what might be perceived by one side or the other to be the wrong thing. But when we go there, we're going to have to keep our eyes open, aren't we? And see, you know, see what we are presented with by the race and by the organisation, but also look a little bit further afield from that. Daniel just dropped in to discussions earlier that he won't be able to make it, will he? Because it clashes with the Tour de Yorkshire, which has also moved its date. So that will take place on the opening weekend of the Giro. Maybe if it doesn't work out in Israel, the Tour de Yorkshire could become the opening 3 days.
Do you know what? I actually thought that.
Don't tell Gary Verity.
Oh my God. He'll be ironing his pink chinos as we speak.
I'm sure he's already thought of that. Anyway, let's wrap things up for this week because there was a lot to listen to this week. So we'll be back. Will we be back next week, or do we have something else to listen to next week, Lionel?
I think we might have a lunch with next week. And then we'll do a ramble the following week. Mm. And then the big one, Cassiolet Night, the Cassiolet Night podcast. Fantastic. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning I've been distracted by other things. That was what I was referring to. I've had to confit some duck legs.
Well, we call that one, we rename that one the Cassoulet podcast.
What is this? I don't know anything about this. Apart, I've seen graphic pictures of Lionel's Cassoulet on.
Will I just fade
online
him out again, Lionel?
Well, we've been set the challenge by Hayden Groves, the Grand Tour riding chef.
Award-winning chef.
And we thought we'll have an end-of-year Cassoulet. And basically I'm making it, so I've already started. And he said, are you going to confit your own duck legs rather than buy them already done?
What's he got?
I'm doing the starter. Orla's going to do the dessert. So Doritos and hummus for a starter, maybe some breadsticks. And then Orla's going to do something.
Not mango, beans and not meat. Mango chicken. That used to be your classic on date nights, Rich.
Yeah, that was my signature dish. You're absolutely right. It's a while since.
But what has any of this got to do with podcasts or cycling? I don't understand.
Well, Hayden, I know the link. Three Grand Tours a day ahead, and he's produced a Grand Tour cookbook, which is, I don't think that's what it's called, but he's produced a book with a recipe from every stage of each of the Grand Tours. So basically, we're picking a recipe each from the book. He's going to assess our cooking. We are going to talk about cycling as well on the night. So
okay,
that'll be should be fun.
Yeah. I might be busy that week.
No, you're very welcome to join us, Daniel, if you can make it back. Anyway, let's leave it there. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.